Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and get an update from William K. Black, who has just returned from the World Economic Forum in Davos. Since he was the chief prosecutor who jailed hundreds of bankers responsible for the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s, we'll also discuss the fallout from a recent Frontline documentary examining why no Wall Street bankers have gone to jail for creating the Great Recession that has impoverished millions of Americans. And we'll look into the appointment of the new head at the Securities Exchange Commission. Then, as Israel deploys its Iron Dome anti-missile system on the Syrian border, we'll examine Iran's determination to prop up the Assad dictatorship and the role of their proxy Hezbollah inside Syria. Aram Nagezian, who is an expert on Syria at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, joins us to explain the strategic landscape in this increasingly complex proxy war that is destroying Syria, turning its citizens into refugees, and has no end in sight. Then finally, we'll examine a Republican scheme to rig the Electoral College so that the loser can win the next presidency. Robert Ritchie, the co-founder and executive director of Fair Vote, joins us to discuss the recent failed Republican effort in Virginia to rig the vote in their favor and plans to enact so-called Electoral College reform in other key swing states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Ohio. And joining us now is William K. Black, who is the former litigation director for the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s. Currently, he is a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He was the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007, and is the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. And he just returned from the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Welcome to Background Briefing, William K. Black.
Thank you.
And apart from the topless demonstrators from Femen, a feminist group out of the Ukraine, I'm not sure what happened much in Davos in terms of the fate of the world economy, except that the head of the IMF, Christine Lagarde, says that the outlook of the global economy is fragile and timid in terms of a recovery, and she warned against complacency. What was your takeaway?
Well, we were in Davos to do a counter-Davos activity. And this is the Shame Prize, the annual Shame Prize, that the Berne Declaration and Greenpeace administer, but is voted on, in one case, by a jury of people, and in another case, by the general public. And the recipients of the shaming were this year Goldman Sachs, which is what I was out for, and Shell for its Arctic development. And I was asked to give a talk that wasn't so much specifically on Goldman Sachs, although I did a long paper about their many frauds, which concentrate, their consistent theme is stealing from their own customers. But to put it in broader context of why we are having these recurrent intensifying financial crises and why the World Economic Forum's activities actually make business far more criminogenic and help produce the frauds that cause the devastation and also cause the World Economic Forum policy ideas and projections to end up being so embarrassingly bad.
Well, my understanding, Bill, is that you put away hundreds of bankers responsible for the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s, and nobody significant has gone to jail as a result of the Wall Street crash of 2008. And there was a very effective Frontline documentary about that last week. And I also interviewed the filmmaker of that, Martin Smith, of that piece. It's gotten a certain amount of attention. It may have led to Lenny Brewer, the Assistant Attorney General, who's manifestly failed in his investigation of Wall Street. He's stepping down. Also, there's been Mary Jo White, a former federal prosecutor, has now been appointed head of the SEC, which has been greeted with a lot of skepticism. So let me start with this premise, which Michael Greenberger, the former Director of Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, he told me recently that the real concern is that if there is another meltdown like 2008 on Wall Street, we simply don't have the money to bail them out next time. And there is no warning system in place. And unless you have more cops on the beat and people looking at what's going on, then we are heading for another big disaster. So let's start with that premise and then, and if you will, answer the questions about what kind of cops do we have on the beat now.
Okay, so the two things tie together quite nicely. I was certainly interviewed a number of times by the frontline staff in preparation for that documentary, and they also did a written piece in conjunction with it that has the direct quotations from some of the interviews that I did. In response to what I said, which was that the regulators had eliminated essentially the criminal referral process, that was not important, it was essential if you wanted to get any major prosecutions. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency issued a press release trying to refute what I was saying. So I pointed out that our agency alone, the Office of Thrift Supervision, made over 30,000 criminal referrals in the savings and loan debacle, and that this was essential to producing the over 1,000 convictions of elites in cases designated as major by the Justice Department. And again, I think your listeners have heard how we hyper-prioritized it. So that was really the 600 worst frauds were virtually all prosecuted and with a 90% conviction rate. And then I said, go forward to the current crisis, and the Office of Thrift Supervision made zero criminal referrals. And depending on which person you, a spokesperson you believe at the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, it made either zero or three criminal referrals. They've given slightly contradictory answers, but of course three is the same as zero in the grand scheme of things. It is beyond trivial or below trivial, whichever way you want to phrase it. So the Office of Comptroller of the Currency was quite stung by this, and they said that it was irrelevant that they had not made any referrals, because first, referrals are made by the institutions, in other words, by the banks. And of course, we had always explained that banks don't make criminal referrals against their own CEOs.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, surprise, surprise. But apparently the OCC is surprised. And so it's got no criminal referrals on the CEOs. So it concludes that there was no crime by the CEOs.
And what's their relationship to Lanny Brewer? Do they report to him or the other
way
around?
Well, again, Lanny Brewer, what people have to understand is that there are only 2,500 on the best of days, and we rarely have the best of days. There are only 2,500 white-collar specialists at the FBI to do all elite white-collar crime investigations. Of those, even today, only about 300 are assigned to the crisis. Now, this crisis is over 70 times larger, both in losses and in frauds, than the savings and loan crisis, where we had at peak 1,000 FBI agents working our cases. Right? So you get some idea of how insane. But beyond that, again, if you don't get the criminal referrals from the agency, you don't get criminal referrals against the senior executives that actually caused the problem. So what do? You get referrals instead from the banks about little people, about Mary in Fresno, you know, and Ted in Sacramento. and how they allegedly ripped off a bank. It sounds like a big case because it's a $600,000 case, right? It's California. Houses are expensive. But it's, in again, the grand scheme of things, we're talking about millions of fraudulent loans being made per year, primarily in the form of liar's loans. And we know from investigations that it was overwhelmingly lenders who put the lies in liar's loans, and they're not going to make criminal referrals against themselves.
Right. But the amazing thing is that Lanny Breaux in the Frontline documentary was arguing that they didn't have strong enough cases and above the threshold of reasonable doubt, when it's all about paper trails. You've got the world's biggest paper trail here because it was all on paper. There are boxes and boxes of these fraudulent mortgages. So what I came away with from the Frontline documentary, and I've got a lot of mail about it, is that even though they didn't build a case, it didn't say who put the fix in, the overwhelming impression you're left with is somebody put the fix in. It couldn't have been Lanny Breaux alone that decided that nobody was going to go to jail.
Okay, so again, if you don't have criminal fraud, I can't overstress this. It isn't that it's hard, it's impossible. Right. Mm-hmm. There are over 1,300 industries in the United States. There are only 2,500, in fact, there's really only 2,000 FBI agents on a typical day that do white collar. So we have fewer than two FBI agents per industry. So, A, it's obvious they don't have expertise in the industries. They couldn't possibly. And B, they can't walk a beat. So they only investigate when they get a criminal referral. And when they get zero criminal referrals from the agencies, who are the only ones who will make criminal referrals against the senior executives, then what will they investigate? They will not investigate the senior executives. They'll investigate Mary and Ted, as I gave you the example. So what came out and was confirmed by Frontline is what we have been saying for 5 years, that the Justice Department, in fact, has not done a single true investigation for criminal prosecution of any major lender.
And then what about the Securities and Exchange Commission? What is their role in terms of criminal referrals? And, of course, they have a new head, Mary Jo White, a former federal prosecutor, who there has been quite a bit of criticism of that I've been seeing lately.
Sure. So a couple of things. First, the Securities and Exchange Commission, just like the regulatory agencies, cannot bring a criminal prosecution itself, but they can make criminal referrals. They are not, however, someone, an entity, again, that has really significant industry expertise.
Even though their job is to, since they were created under Roosevelt, their job is to monitor Wall Street.
No, their job is to try to get disclosures under securities law. They are not a regulator of any entity. And indeed, the footnote to that is they were actually the faux regulators of the five largest investment banks in America. And they were for about 4 years. And why? Because the EU, the European Union, passed a rule that says there has to be comprehensive regulation. If you don't do it, if your home country doesn't do it, and you do any business in Europe, then we, the EU, will begin regulating you. And so the five biggest investment banks in America ran crying to the Securities and Exchange Commission and said, gin up a supposed regulation. And so they did, and you know how many regulators were assigned to each of the banks, the five largest investment banks in America? Three.
So
now that is a farce, and it was designed to be a farce. So when you ask, who put the fix in? The fix was put in by both the Bush and the Obama administrations at the highest levels. It was pushed in the current administration by Timothy Geithner as Treasury Secretary. And, you know, Lanny Breuer obviously didn't have to be pushed very hard. He and Holder and a whole series of the people under them came from Covington and Burling, where their primary clients were the big banks.
And that's where Lanny Breuer is returning to, right?
Where he's going. He's punched his clock, and now he'll be selling himself as the other folks who came back from Covington as, again, Lanny Breuer's head of their white-collar defense group. Mary Jo White was at one time a pretty effective prosecutor, but I have personally heard her give talks in her new capacity as a leading white-collar defense lawyer, in which she talks about how good it can be to manipulate your earnings as a corporation.
And now she's gone back the other way, right? She's now supposedly a prosecutor as the head of the...
But the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Right.
And yes, it vitally needs a vigorous regulator. Now, the person she replaced was a farce as well. The person she replaced had been in charge of the self-regulatory effort on Wall Street that no one took seriously and was, of course, a complete failure. And the only thing that she accomplished was that she made herself wealthy in that process. And for reasons that go beyond all understanding, except, of course, putting the fix in, that's who President Obama chose.
Well, you know, I'm getting to the point, William K. Black, of utter despair just listening to this. And I'm sure our audience feels the same way, that this system seems to be systemically rigged to prevent any prosecution of these major abuses. And this is the Great Recession we're talking about. It's impoverished millions of Americans. It cost something like $21 trillion of taxpayer money, all of which was entirely wasted.
And 10 million jobs.
And nobody goes to jail.
And nobody elite goes to jail. Lots of married
ones,
Teds
right.
Go to jail, but not a single elite. They actually did send one, or in the process of sending one person from an entity that's too obscure for anyone to have heard of it, but it was a group that did the foreclosures where the person pled to having made more than 1 million felonies.
Well, let's turn then to the first or second part of my question way back, which is that the thing that I got from my recent interview with Michael Greenberg, the former director of markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, that systemically there's no early warning sign on Wall Street. And if one of these big banks goes under, and my understanding is that one of the oldest banks in the world, an Italian bank, is now in huge trouble because of bad derivatives trades. So we've seen what happened recently on Wall Street, where Citicorp lost a whole bunch of $8 billion or whatever on bad trades. If any of these big banks make a series of bad trades, there just isn't any more ability for the taxpayer to bail them out next time. So you would think that Obama and everybody would be now realizing that we have to have a serious regime in place here that's, if you can't prosecute these people, you're going to have to watch them so that they don't do it again. Because if they do it again, the whole system unravels, which was the rationalization for bailing them out last time.
Being prosecuted is the only thing they care about. So it's not important, it's essential. And they have made it impossible to prosecute because they refuse to investigate. And our mantra in white-collar criminology is, if you don't look, you don't find. So Michael is excellent. He is not an economist. I don't think that he would actually be right that we couldn't deal with the next crisis. But the United States, of course, is by far the wealthiest nation in the world. And many other nations could not. They would be reduced to the situation of Iceland, Ireland, Malta, Cyprus, all of these nations that are, you know, just crushed by the debt. So his broader point is certainly true on a global basis. And yes, they have not done, and Michael's real area of expertise, and he's among the best in the world, is on financial derivatives. And I agree with him entirely. Indeed, I go to him for expertise, that the financial derivatives have not been dealt with successfully, and they pose staggering risks to the system. You are correct that the oldest bank in the world has suffered immense losses because of financial derivatives, but also covered up losses, we think, using financial derivatives, which is equally scary. And the news reports suggest that it's about to be bailed out by the Italian central bank. As your listeners may know, Italy is already somewhere between a great recession and depression. Youth unemployment is over 36%. Its banking sector has not been the thing crushing it the most. So if the banking sector starts to go as well, it has a grave risk of going the way of Spain and Greece, which are in full-scale Great Depression levels of unemployment.
Well, just in closing, William K. Black, what are we going to be left with here? Because I say I just don't enjoy feeling this kind of despair, and I'd like to feel that there's something we can do to stop this this criminality and this immunity that these people have.
Well, there is something that we can do, and Frontline again made the point. So we know exactly what it takes to make an extraordinarily successful prosecutorial effort. And it isn't a flash in the pan. It takes years of efforts. We did it over the course of 5 years, but it was the most successful effort against elite white-collar criminals ever. And it's vastly easier this time because we've worked out the kinks. We already made the mistakes in setting up the system. And you could even bring in a number of the best people who had already shown expertise with these systems. But you would have to get rid of the leadership of not only the Justice Department, but the regulatory agencies, such as Mr. Curry at the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, who actually took the position that this is the first virgin crisis in history, conceived without any sin, and that the Office of Thrift Supervision made zero criminal referrals because there were zero crimes by institutions, which is so preposterous that I felt I was in an Ionesco play, and that everyone would start having rhino horns.
Well, William Clayblake, you've given us such a clear picture of what we sort of know in our bones, and I do hope that people are sufficiently outraged to demand more of the president and more of a new attorney general and more of the people that have been appointed, like Mary Jo White, and get a new control of the currency.
Well, if Frontline may actually have pushed Lanny Brewer to resign. So there is no reason to surrender. If you give up, they definitely win. And every reason to spit them in their eye and fight like all hell.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here, William K. Black.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with William K. Black, who was the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s. Currently, he's a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and he was the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007, and is the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. And he just returned from the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about Israel and Iran rattling sabers at each other over Syria. All that diamond dust, blowing up your hopes, flamboyant obstacles, oh, deals made to cope, ideas in decline, rise of the loss, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, here we stand. Slave to networks, master plans. Swag's the brand, open a can. Chains off still, yeah, I never ran. But who do you think you are?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Aram Nagizyam, who is a visiting fellow with the Arleigh Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic International Studies, where he specializes in security, politics, and military development in the Middle East, focusing on the Lebanese military, U.S. and Iranian strategic competition in the Levant, and challenges to civil-military relations in post-conflict and divided societies. He has authored or co-authored a number of reports at CSIS, including Instability in Syria, Assessing the Risks of Military Intervention, U.S.-Iranian Strategic Competition, the Proxy Cold War in the Levant, and he is the author of Israel and Syria, The Military Balance and the Prospects of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aram Nagizyam.
I'm happy to be back, Ian.
And can you connect some of the dots for us that are out there, Aram, in terms of, for example, I mean, I know they're all over the place, but you've got the Israelis deploying their Iron Dome anti-missile system on the Syrian border with comments from senior Israeli officials that the Iranians have brought in Hezbollah fighters into the war in Syria, and that they may turn over chemical weapons to Hezbollah. You've got the former foreign minister of Iran, now an aide to the Ayatollah, the supreme leader, saying that Iran considers any attack against Syria an attack on itself. And you've got Israel's departing defense minister, Ehud Barak, at Davos, saying that the Pentagon has prepared sophisticated blueprints of surgical scalpel-like operations to neutralize Iran's nuclear program. So I'm giving you a difficult, an unenviable task there. But is there anything to all of these movements in this increasingly complex proxy war?
Well, certainly there's a lot. The complexity you pointed out to a lot of it, and I'll try to condense it in less than our usual 300-page reports. But basically, you have an arena that has grown increasingly complex. It is only natural for countries like Israel, Jordan, Turkey, even Lebanon and Iraq to try and map out contingencies based on their domestic political arenas. The Israelis have been tracking, especially activity along the Golan for some time. You know, a lot of the posturing by the Assad regime about opening up a front on the Golan has been perceived by analysts in the West as little more than posturing, an effort to shift the focus away from the country's internal crisis. But the reality is that you have a multi-vector conflict. You have moderate fighting factions in the opposition. You have a number of extremist elements. You have a regime that is changing. You have an insurgency that is changing. And in that, you do have the prospect of some of these fighting groups mobilizing a very broad and publicly accepted view that Israel is the opponent of the average Syrian, that there are domestic grievances that can be utilized in the struggle. And I would not be surprised if at some point you had elements of the opposition that tried to gain more public support, gain more legitimacy by undertaking activities either on or close to the Golan Heights. And you have an Israeli defense establishment that's going to try and act according to that. And the challenge is not just from some of these groups that are fighting Assad. You also have an Assad regime that is learning, that is adapting, and that is finding new ways to compete and to combat the insurgency. And part of that is their own new tactics and utilizing Syrian resources. But the other side of this is that the Iranians, along with Hezbollah, have been very active in trying to shift some of the terms of the balance of power in the country. You remember, you have a predominantly Sunni opposition that includes some moderates but increasingly is being personified by the successes of more extreme groups, in some cases groups with ties to Al-Qaeda, like the Nusra Front. For better or for worse, countries in the Gulf like Qatar and Saudi Arabia and also Turkey and indirectly the West have been supporting this Sunni majority insurgency to varying degrees. And on the other side of this, you have Iran. And in many ways with Iraqi Shiites and Lebanese Shiites that have been buttressing the other side of this alongside the Assad regime. And while there are concerns in Israel about chemical weapon transfers to Hezbollah, that's nothing really new. We've been hearing about this for quite some time. Frankly, I think the concerns of that are far more vocal here in Western capitals. I think that the Israelis have a much more nuanced local understanding of where they fit in the balance of terror with Hezbollah. I mean, Hezbollah has a lot to lose, especially if they were to acquire systems like those that are in Syrian inventory in terms of chemical weapons. I mean, they're already dealing with significant transfers of weapons over the last 20 months. The Assad regime has accelerated the scale and the pace of transfers in 2011 and in parts of 2012. But there's only so much that Hezbollah can absorb in terms of transfers without having problems in hiding its inventory and without exposing itself to undue risk of attack from Israel. So you have a Hezbollah backed by Iran that is on the one hand engaged in helping the Assad regime, and I'd be happy to talk about how they're doing that, but at the same time trying to stave off the perception that somehow they are preparing for direct confrontation with the Israelis. And the message that I got during my last trip to the region is that the Shiites of Lebanon are basically juggling multiple agendas. They're juggling an effort to fight alongside Assad for very pragmatic and very self-interested reasons, namely in their own perception of where they fit in a broader regional Sunni-Shiite contest, where if Assad were to lose, it would somehow threaten the autonomy of Hezbollah, but also the political autonomy of Shiites in Lebanon. But at the same time, trying to minimize tension with Lebanon's own Sunni community. And at the same time, on a third front, trying to mitigate against any miscommunication or false flags with the Israelis in order to avert a conflict with the Israelis, which would probably expose Hezbollah at a time when they're trying to do all things at the same time without triggering a major escalation on any of the key fronts that they're concerned with. So, you know, if we thought Syria was going to be complex, it's only getting more complex. This is only talking about a very limited number of the interested actors involved in the conflict. If you were to talk about things tied to Jordan, Turkey, Iraq, you can imagine similar layers of complexity. So this lays out where things sit vis-a-vis Israel, Hezbollah, and Syria.
So, Aram Nirgizian, again, visiting fellow with the Ali Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic International Studies. The Syrian opposition and their international sponsors are meeting in Paris. They've had a series of meetings. There's always been a confidence in the West that Assad will go, largely expressed by outgoing Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. On the other hand, Iran seems to be confident that they're able to supply. And so I think to some extent the Russians, although there have been rumors of Russians evacuating, give us a sense of what's really happening in terms of who's winning or losing. Because my impression is this thing could go on for a long time, in spite of the optimistic statements from Hillary Clinton.
Well, you'd be right about that, Ian, and there's a reason why we've been very careful about the kinds of analysis we put out, because there are two defining qualities of the cycle of confrontation in Syria. The first is that both the opposition, and that's a very loose term, I mean, I'm not even comfortable using the term Free Syrian Army anymore, or as a very generalized term to describe the armed insurgency. Well, the opponents of the Assad regime and the Assad regime first are both learning, adapting, and figuring out new ways to fight what is essentially a war of attrition. the opposition benefits from external support from the Gulf, political and in some cases logistical support from Turkey, and just the overarching level of support from within the Sunni community, whether it's in terms of Muslim Brotherhood support at the regional level or in terms of the broader dividing fault line between Sunni Saudi Arabia and Shiite Iran. But the problem there is that the Assad regime is also learning, also adapting. They have changed their strategy. They're focusing far less on major offensive operations in the north. They're focusing on defending the inner core of the regime tied to Damascus and key urban centers and not losing major ones like Aleppo outright. And in parallel to that, they're also finding new ways to relieve pressure from the Assad regime. So things like creating this national defense army of new recruits and also really trying to beef up in terms of quantity and quality the Shabiha and other loyalist and sectarian units. So this is the first key pattern, which is that as one side learns, the other side learns as well, which means that you have this potential long-term cycle of attrition, which is being fueled by local, regional, and international forces. The other key factor, and this is something that is difficult to say, but it really is a defining dimension of this conflict during an age of high speed and instant communication, is that you essentially have a liar's contest. You have an Assad regime that is trying to frame a narrative that of victory, that they can achieve complete victory against the opposition. And you also have an opposition that is working very hard to shape reality. Now, this is nothing new. In any civil conflict, let alone broader intrastate conflict, you do have both sides engaged in propaganda and information warfare. This is no different. It's just that it's happening during an age where you have Twitter, where you have YouTube, and where you have a role for a free press, but a free press that, frankly, is not able to perform in ways that provides the average observer with realistic metrics. Even if you did have a strong press presence in Syria, you have important lessons from Lebanon and from Iraq, which are that at some point, whether it's the media, whether it's analysts, whether it's elements of national intelligence agencies, you come to a stark conclusion, which is that whenever a conflict like this drags on as long as it does, we just don't know. We just don't have a clear sense of where the metrics really are, which is why talking about tipping points, talking about game-changing moments, all of these things can be very quickly trivialized by the fact that the balance of power is shifting constantly. We've been talking about Assad's eventual departure for the last almost year and a half now. And it's important to remember, Ian, that at the beginning of this debate, when you had the State Department and the Department of Defense advising the White House about what the official guidance should be, it was very clear to me from the onset that there was a lot of reluctance within the Department of Defense to move quickly on this idea that Assad should be called on to leave by the president. And in many ways, if you look at where this all started in terms of the U.S. posture and where things stand now, one thing remains consistent, and that is that it's not so much about the U.S. leading from behind, it is about the U.S. being pushed from behind, pushed by regional events, pushed by regional allies, pushed by regional and international opponents. And that's where things stand now. We still have no clear picture where this is all going. There are no good options on the table in what is an existential conflict for the Alawites and what is a struggle for the post-Ottoman legacy in Syria. And as you pointed out, this conflict could go on for many, many more years, which is why, while we are tempted to think about things like intervention and military action, the lesson, again, from a conflict from previous decades, like the Lebanese Civil War, is that you will have multiple efforts to win by competing factions, and you will have multiple efforts to solve and settle the conflict with peace agreements. And while there might be a dozen such efforts, at some point, either because of luck or by change in the balance, one of those efforts might actually stick. And as pessimistic as my assessment might sound to a lot of folks who know the work we do, there is a long-term optimism here, which is that at some point you have to negotiate an outcome. The alternative is that at some point we're going to look back and say, wow, 60,000 fatalities was actually a low number. We've hit the multiple 100,000 levels. similar to the Algeria conflict. And that's not somewhere anybody wants to be, let alone the leadership here in the United States government.
Well, just in closing, in the last couple of minutes, Aram Nagezian, so in the meanwhile, Syria is being destroyed and its citizens are being turned into refugees, and there's no end in sight. And it does seem that, at least in terms of the Iranians and the Russians to a lesser degree, they seem to at least know what they're doing. We seem to, in the West, and particularly the United States, seem to know what we don't want, but we don't know what we do want.
One of the core challenges is that the Iranians and the Russians, for different reasons and with different end states in mind, have a similar overarching strategy, which is not to lose, versus the approach of countries like the United States, which is predicated on winning. Winning means defeating Assad, creating a stable government that tries to represent the maximum amount of people in Syria, eventually creating a stable peace environment or a peace process of some kind, and holding all of this together despite the fact that you've had tens of thousands of fatalities. Frankly, the challenge facing Iran and Russia is much easier, or at least not as daunting. What could happen in their case is if they lose Assad, they will have to face the prospect of finding new ways to maintain or sustain the equilibrium that exists today in the Levant, which means that if you have Assad leave power, or if he's assassinated, or if some other major shift comes along, Iran and their regional international allies will find some way to make sure that a stable pro-Western government does not emerge, let alone a Sunni-dominated one. So the thresholds are fundamentally different. You have a U.S. and a country that is focused on humanitarian and economic development on the one hand, and their allies at the regional international level with a broad mix of strategies versus Iran and Russia. The other challenge is, frankly, that 2 years on, if you were to try and peg where U.S. policy sits in terms of where the lead is, where the leadership is, who the key players in the U.S. interagency are, well, if we knew that a year ago, and frankly we didn't, now you have even more instability given the fact that you have a shuffle within the National Security Council. You have new appointments due in the State Department and the Department of Defense. So it's not to say that U.S. policy is in flux. It's just that we have no more direction than we did a few months ago.
Well, Aram Nagezian, I thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Aram Nagezian, who's a visiting fellow with the Ali Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where he specializes in security politics and military development in the Middle East, focusing on the Lebanese military, U.S. and Iranian strategic competition in the Levant, and challenges to civil-military relations in post-conflict and divided societies. He has authored and co-authored a number of reports at CSIS, including Instability in Syria, Assessing the Risk of Military Intervention, U.S.-Iranian Strategic Competition, The Proxy Cold War in the Levant, and he is the author of Israel and Syria, The Military Balance and the Prospects of War. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about Republican efforts to rig the vote in the Electoral College.
Come, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls, for the times they are a-changing.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Ritchie, who's the co-founder and executive director of Fair Vote. He writes, speaks, and testifies frequently on issues of voting and democratic participation. Prior to founding the center, he worked for three winning congressional campaigns in Washington State and for nonprofit organizations in Washington and the District of Columbia. He's the co-author of two books, Every Vote Equal and With Stephen Hill, Whose Vote Counts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Ritchie.
Thanks so much. Good to be on the program.
And it looks as though Republican efforts by the legislature in Virginia to change the Electoral College or the apportionment of votes to the Electoral College in the state of Virginia have failed, with the governor showing some reluctance and a couple of Republicans who they managed to get a kind of stealth vote in during the inauguration when a key Democrat was missing. But they seem to have backed down a little bit. But that's not to say that efforts are still underway in these other key swing states of Ohio being the big one, and Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. So is that the situation?
Yeah. Well, just as a reminder, states have the right to choose how to allocate their electoral votes, and the rule that is prevalent in almost every state is that whoever wins the popular vote in that state gets all of the electoral votes. But that wasn't actually common early on. A lot of states didn't even have elections. And, so it is a rule that, even though we don't really look at it much, it is something that can be changed. And it sort of can be shocking when it's done in a way that is, so clearly unfair. The thing that Republicans have been frustrated by is that there are certain states that are close, but they keep losing. Like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, they have not won since the 80s. And, they often get on the swing state list, but, these swing states that they always lose, they've got a lot of electoral votes. They always end up with the Democrats. And they run the state government. And so they're saying, maybe we can do something different. And so the proposal that has been getting the most attention is to change to how to allocate electoral votes by congressional district. Every state has the same number of electoral votes as districts, and then they have two more than that. They're sort of Senate electors. The Virginia proposal would actually have given those Senate electors to whoever won the most congressional districts in the state, which would have given, last year, Romney 9 out of the state's 13 electoral votes to use this plan.
Even though he lost the popular vote in the state.
Exactly. And, in fact, if that plan was put in all the six states where this dynamic exists, in each one of them, Romney would have won more electoral votes, even while losing the popular vote in each one of them. And if they all had done this, actually he would have won the election. And that's the kind of, shocking, plausible outcome that people were talking about. It's not something that can't still happen by 2016. The Virginia proposal definitely seems dead for this year. But there'll be a new governor come next year. There'll be new calculations to make as we get closer to 2016. And we sort of keep this ticking time bomb with this current electoral college system that, is fraught with problems. But this is, yet one more that really could actually change a whole presidential outcome. By targeting the three states that they keep losing, that's Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, they can't control who wins, but they can give a big boost to the Republican nominee, because essentially they can, by just changing to a district system or a proportional allocation of electoral vote system, they can give the Republican nominee more electoral votes than what they win by winning or losing Ohio. It's a pretty big swing of electoral votes, and it doesn't guarantee that they win, but it's a big boost toward doing so. And there's a real chance that it still may move in those states in the next year.
And, of course, there are two states that have this system that the Republicans are now trying to implement in these key swing states. That's Maine and Nebraska. But I'm just curious to know how you could run a country with a deficit of, let's assume, that they had put this stuff in before this last election and we would have had the same results, and yet Romney would have won the Electoral College and Obama would have been 5 million votes ahead in the popular vote. A similar situation took place back in 2004 in Ohio, where I think Bush was 1.3 million ahead in the popular vote, but Kerry, had he won Ohio, would have won the presidency. And then you go back to 2000, when Bush won, even though he was 660,000 behind in the popular vote, because of he eventually was able to win Florida in the courts. I'm just curious to know how you can run a country, the lone superpower, with this kind of time bomb in its political DNA.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, part of it is that we tend to, you know, there's a bit of sticking the head in the sand, ostrich style or something here, where, you know, we kind of dodged a bullet. Like, you know, there was, say, one thing that could have happened last year is that it could have been a tie in the electoral vote. Of course, Obama ended up winning substantially. He, you know, won by 5 million votes. But if it had been closer, there was a real chance that they actually might have ended up in a tie. And if it's a tie, no matter what, this is in the electoral vote, even if one candidate has won more popular votes, it goes to Congress, and the House of Representatives picks the president on the basis of one state, one vote, which would mean that Delaware would get a vote, and so would California, and they would each get just one. And, you know, and whoever gets 26 state votes wins. You know, a really completely sort of a rational system. Yet they don't change that either, right? It's sort of like there's sort of like this head in the stand kind of stuff, because, well, it hasn't happened yet, and then it happens, and it's, you know, too late to change it. There is a great way to change this, which I want to make sure that this book, Every Vote Equal, which will have a new edition this year, kind of laying out the case for change and all the, you know, trying to answer all the questions that people have about the proposal. But it's to go to a national popular vote for president, which people usually assume can be would be done by abolishing the Electoral College and just, you know, having a straight-up popular vote that way. But you can also have a straight-up popular vote through action in the states. And that's what this national popular vote proposal has been creating the opportunity for. We now have 8 states in D.C. that have passed the law. And the law says we will give all of our electoral votes to the winner of the national popular vote in all 50 states once the number of states that have passed this with us together have a majority in the Electoral College. So currently we have 132 electoral votes in the states that have passed this. When we get up to 270 in the next election, it'll kick in, it'll be activated, there'll be an interstate, you know, kind of treaty that has been signed into by the states, and they will guarantee that whoever gets the most votes in all 50 states is going to be the president, and all this kind of shenanigans wouldn't matter. And it's something that, you know, and we wouldn't have the wrong way outcome that you rightly laid out, you know, happened in 2000 and could have in 2004. And every vote would be equal. Like, I live in Maryland, and, you know, you're in California, and all these states where they're just completely written off, election after election, would be able to participate on an equal basis with Ohio and Florida.
Again, I'm speaking with Rob Ritchie, the co-founder and executive director of Fair Vote. He's also the co-author of 2 books, Every Vote Equal, which you just mentioned is coming out again, with this proposal to change the Electoral College. With Stephen Hill, he wrote Whose Votes Count. So clearly there's been a history of both sides, both the Democrats and the Republicans, gaming this dysfunctional electoral system we have in the states, which is controlled by the states. And that goes back to the Founding Fathers, who the first insistence on the part of the states to join, the first 13 colonies to join the Union, were that they wanted to control their own elections. And we're stuck with that system. But over the years, of course, you know, Jack Kennedy got elected because of a bunch of dead people in southern Illinois. So it's gone on both sides. But it seems much lately the Republicans, in order to overcome their demographic disadvantage with the minorities and with women, seem to be getting more and more ruthless, and the Democrats seem to be getting more and more feckless. So it's, to my mind, we could end up with a much, much, and if you combine what's been happening now with the use of the filibuster, which has become, you know, used almost for every vote in the Senate now, and now the national ruling by the D.C. District Court, which is heavily slanted to in favor of Republicans, because the Republicans have been able to put more of their judges on the courts because they filibustered Democratic nominees. And so you got the judiciary that's becoming heavily slanted with right-wing Republican judges. And you've got this kind of aggressiveness with Reince Priebus and other Republicans who want to push through this clearly rigged system that they think they might be able to get away with. So I don't know how you can shame people who have no shame, but what can we do to have a real level playing field in this country and stop this incredibly anti-democratic shenanigans? Which is putting it politely, by the way.
Yeah, right. Well, I think all of that is correct. And you know, also the fact that both major parties do this. And, you know, one way they do it is they always collude against minor parties and, you know, trying to keep independents and third parties at bay and not have them in debates and, you know, sort of ways of doing things for their own advantage and not for democracy. But I think that the excuse me, I'm going to have to cough. It seems like everyone I'm talking to is sick these days, and so am I. But the movement I think we need to have is one that sort of puts democracy first, holds our elected officials accountable when they're not, and really keeps that principle applied to a lot of different things. Like, we already can see with congressional elections a wrong way outcome, right? Last year, the Democrats won more votes in the House of Representatives, and the Republicans ended up with 33 more seats, and that's partly due to gerrymandering and, you know, the way the district lines were drawn. But it's really more due to the fact that just where people live these days, the Democratic vote is more concentrated, and they kind of waste votes by, you know, kind of winning certain districts 90-10, and that doesn't help them any more than if they won 60-40. And that's an example of something where we think we just need to open up congressional elections to a non-winner-take-all system of proportional representation. That book you mentioned, Whose Votes Counts, lays out you know, the case for proportional representation. But I think that that's an example of sort of a daring idea that is one that's a little nerve-wracking for Democratic incumbents, too, because it makes them have to run in competitive elections. But it's the right thing to do for voters, and it's actually the right thing for Democrats to do politically, because right now they're really behind the ball in House races in a way that's going to be very hard for them to win a majority anytime soon. And just, you know, start doing things that, you know, put your political lives a bit at risk, but are the right thing for voters. And I think it's ultimately, at this point in time, it's the right politics for certainly Democrats to do, and I think for any Republicans that don't want their party to just be sort of stuck in this certain, I think, minority position that leads them to a psychology of thinking that the only way they can win is cheating rather than figuring out a way to win, you know, to win the most votes again.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Robert Ritchie.
Thank you. And people should check out fairvote.org and our sort of action-oriented website, fairvoteaction.org, about things that you can do in your community to make a difference on this stuff.
Again, I thank you for joining us. Robert Ritchie is the co-founder and executive director of Fair Vote. He writes, speaks, and testifies frequently on issues of voting and democratic participation. And prior to founding the Fair Vote, he worked for three winning congressional campaigns in Washington State and for a nonprofit organizations in Washington, D.C. and the District of Columbia. He's the co-author of two books, Every Vote Equal and with Stephen Hill, Whose Vote Counts. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305.